I'm Andrew Hall, an editor at Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, coming to you from Fukuoka, Japan. And today's show is our annual Mormon Studies Books in Review Roundup for books published in 2026 or thereabouts. And today I'm joined by two wonderful colleagues, Nicholas Shrum, who is our new nonfiction book review editor at Dialogue, and Andrew Hamilton, who has joined me several times in recent years, who is the book review editor at the Association for Mormon Letters. Nicholas, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure, happy to. First of all, honored to be on the roundup with the two of you. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Virginia in religious studies, where I study American religious history. And I'm currently dissertating as the Tanner Humanities Center Mormon Studies Fellow at the University of Utah. And so I'll be doing that for the next little bit, but happy to be here and to talk about all these great books.
Andrew, go ahead.
Hello, my name is Andrew Hamilton. I've been reviewing books for the Association for Mormon Letters for about 20 years now, I suppose. And I've been the editor, book review editor for the Association for Mormon Letters for since about 2018, something like that. And I teach English at the college in Southern Idaho, and happy to be here.
Great. All right. Well, we got a long list of books to discuss, so let's go ahead and jump into that. Let's start with biographies, actually. We have several great biographies. Nick, do you want to start us off with that?
John G. Turner, who's a professor at George Mason, recently came out with a biography on Joseph Smith entitled Joseph Smith, The Rise and Fall of an American Prophet, with Yale University Press. This came out over the summer, and it's quite a hit. I've had the opportunity to read that and to also talk with Professor Turner about this book. This is a fabulous book. Sometimes we think, how can we write more about Joseph Smith with Fawn Brody and Richard Bushman and other Dan Vogel and others that have written extensively about him? But John Turner brings a really fresh, historically rich and contextual history to the life of Joseph Smith, and it moves at a really fast clip, so readers can get a sense of kind of the hectic pace of his life. And so, but heavily recommend this book.
All right. Yes, that's been really the story of the year, is this book coming out. We'd done this great book about Brigham Young before, and now moving on to Joseph Smith. And I think, you know, it's been a challenging book to a lot of people, but fair. I don't think anybody who's ever looked at this book has said it's not fair. So,
no, I agree.
Okay, Andrew, you have some more biographies you want to mention?
Yeah, several biographies. The first one I want to mention is called The Blood in Their Veins, The Kimballs, Polygamy, and the Shaping of Mormonism. Now, you know, if there's maybe a royal family in Mormonism, if you can use that term outside of the Smiths and maybe the Youngs, it would be the Kimballs. You had Heber C. Kimball right there at the very beginning, and his family, at least up through Spencer W. Kimball, been very heavily involved in the church. And this book kind of goes through, and it's a bit of a biography of the family, and it highlights some members I'm sure many people have heard of, such as Helen Kimball, the youngest plural wife of Joseph Smith, J. Goldman Kimball, and a number of others. And it talks about their connections with polygamy and church history, and weaves together a fantastic and interesting story, written by Andrew Kimball, grandson of Spencer W. and the co-author of the biography that came out in the 70s on him. And that's kind of a fun and fascinating book. Another pretty interesting one, a little more local to Idaho maybe, but I think people elsewhere and find interest in it. I actually found out about this one when the author came and spoke at Sunstone this last summer. It's called No Forgiveness, Family, Polygamy, Murder, and Justice Among Idaho's Pioneering Mormons. And it's by Daniel Neal. And back in 1911, his grandfather, D.S. Neal, went out to water his fields one day, a member of a ward up here in Idaho, descended from 19th century polygamy. And his neighbor, a man named Ellington Smith, as fellow member of the ward, also with connections from polygamy, murdered him. And he goes through the story of this murder and the trial and everything that was kind of involved in that, and the connections to polygamy and other things, and kind of a fun and interesting story there, especially if you like local history and kind of different aspects of Mormon history that maybe you're familiar with. That one kind of for the kids, or maybe primary, older primary level. It's called Change Makers, Women Who Boldly Built Zion. The authors are MacArthur Krishna and Anne Pimentel. I'm probably slaughtering pronouncing their names. I apologize, ladies. From Signature Books. And it's a fun little book that highlights stories of a number of women. Each story is no more than a couple of pages long, a few paragraphs and some pictures. Covers women from the scriptures, like Lois and Eunice and Lydia, people like Emma Smith and early church history, as well as much more recent women who've been involved in the history of the LDS Church, with the final entry being about Melissa Inouye, who we lost here not too long ago. And so some fun stories about a variety of different women in that one. A couple more to round off our biographies here tonight. Nicholas, a moment ago, said, you know, how some people might think, how can we possibly see any more about Joseph Smith? If we're going to see that maybe about any other church leader, my David O. McKay shelf is probably as big as my Joseph Smith shelf. There's been a lot of biographies of David O. McKay, and the Greg Prince one being one of the longest and most in-depth a few years ago. So you might possibly feel kind of the same way. But this is Building a Global Zion, The Life and Vision of David O. McKay by Brian Q. Cannon from down at BYU, also published by Signature Books. And he was asked to write this several years ago. And with a lot of the materials that have been made available lately through prints and others, was able to do some new research and provide some pretty interesting details. It's a fairly brief biography. It's only about 250 pages long, but provides some new and good insights on the spread of the church around the world during David O. McKay's time. Talks about his world tour, his apostleship, some of the things he did while he was prophet. And it's a pretty fun and interesting book. If you remember or like David O. McKay at all, or you're interested in that kind of mid-20th century period, then it's a very good book to have. One final biography I'm just going to touch on very briefly, because it came out in December. I got a copy, haven't really had a chance to look at it yet too much, is The Life and Times of John Steele, Mormon Kingdom Builder, by Kerry William Bates through the University of Utah Press. And he was heavily involved in Parowan and Las Vegas and Southern Utah in the early days, and provides a little more history and kind of background in that area. So a few fun biographies to check out from this last year.
Okay. Thanks, Andrew. All right. So let's go to some other non-biography histories. So Nicholas, tell us about the books you want to mention.
Yeah, so I'll mention two that I thought were really important and frankly groundbreaking books, in my opinion. The first is Holiness to the Lord, Latter-day Saint Temple Worship by Jonathan A. Stapley, who's a historian and a scientist that a few years ago, his book, The Power of Godliness, won the MHA Book of the Year Award. This is a really, really in my opinion, expertly written book about the temple. I think that the audience for this book could range from everyday members of the church that want to put temple worship into a historical context to see how it's developed over time. Excellent chapters that are introductory to people that are not members of the church. There's a little bit of, I think the way that it's written, it leads well to comparative work, to thinking about ritual and narrative and cosmology. There's a lot of really, really wonderful things that Jonathan Stapley touches on in this book. And really notably, towards the end of the book, has a fascinating chapter on how central race is to the Latter-day Saint temple liturgy, and to kind of the way that the temple has been thought of and practiced over its history, and kind of the role that the lifting of the temple and priesthood ban on people of Black African descent changed fundamentally in many ways the way that the temple is understood. So again, another one that's really, really well written, and that's from Oxford University Press. That came out near the end of the year. The next one is Between the Temple and the Tax Collector, The Intersection of Mormonism and the State. And this book was written by Samuel D. Brunson, who's a professor of law at Loyola University Chicago School of Law. And Professor Brunson talks about a whole bunch of different case studies from the 19th to the 20th century, well into the 21st century as well, about how the LDS Church has interacted with taxes, whether that's in the Utah Territory and in Nauvoo, kind of how taxes figure into the religious thought of early Mormons, but then also like controversies and kind of how it's through taxes and it's through financial considerations that we can understand how the church and its people have thought of themselves in relationship to the not just the American state, but other states as well, including Canada has a great chapter on polygamy and fundamentalism in Canada in the 20th century. So this is a great book that takes a less trodden angle. Sometimes one would think tax law is one of the less exciting places to analyze and think about Mormon studies, but Professor Brunson, this is a really exciting and fun read.
He's kind of the go-to guy to talk about financial issues today when like issues of mm-hmm. church wealth comes up and what the church is doing with its wealth. He often writes about that in a very informed way. Does he come up to the current day and those kind of issues?
He does indeed. And he talks about, where many of the cultural issues that the church faces leading into the 21st century, and including, same-sex marriage and other issues that, where the rubber hits the road in many ways with taxes in the church. And he does a great job navigating that and gives a very balanced and helpful history of that.
Okay, great. And then you want to tell us about Mediated Mormons as well, right?
Yeah, of course. And then if Andrew Hamilton wants to jump in as well, this was another one of my favorites from this year, Mediated Mormons, Shifting Religious Identities in the Digital Age by Rosemary Avance. And Rosemary is a professor of media and strategic communications at Oklahoma State University. This book was published with the University of Utah Press. And this is a look at Mormon studies. Chronologically, it's looking around what's commonly known as the Mormon moment of around 2010 to 2012. So we have the Book of Mormon musical, Mitt Romney's campaign, kind of a high point of online Mormonism with blogs and Reddit boards and that kind of thing. And so Professor Avance uses this moment to bring in a media studies lens to think about how Latter-day Saints construct their own identity as Mormons, given how, other people in the United States are thinking about Mormon identity, and then the various interests that Mormons bring to the digital sphere. And really excellent analysis and considerations of just how much digital technology has fundamentally changed religious identity in the 21st century. So not just for Mormonism, but I think highly relevant for any religious tradition or Christian denomination or anything like that.
That was an excellent analysis, Nicholas. I don't know that I have too much to add. There's definitely been a big shift, I think, in Mormon identity recently, and she does a great job of highlighting how the modern media plays into that and what was going on in that Mormon moment. Excellent. Yeah. Thank you very much.
And it's the most recent of a very recent wave of these studies of media studies, these media studies books. So we had Mason Allred, Seeing Things, Technologies of Vision and Making of Mormonism, and Gavin Feller's Eternity in the Ether, A Mormon Media History, just a couple of years ago. And then for them to have this book come out, you know, in their wake is, it's a real school of thought developing there. Okay, so Andrew, you want to tell us about some more history books?
Yeah, I have a few to mention. So if you're listening to this podcast right now, you've probably figured out Mormons love books. We love reading them. We love writing them. We love publishing them. This book that I first want to mention has a very long title, The Juvenile Instructor Office, The Growth of Specialized Publishing in Utah in the 1880s, A History and Bibliography by Craig S. Smith. This is from Coford Books. And he highlights how beginning in about 1865, but especially through the 1880s, George Q. Cannon began doing publishing in Utah in what became known as the Juvenile Instructor's Office, the Juvenile Instructor being one of the longest running ever magazines that was published by the church. And he highlights not only that particular magazine publication, but everything else that office and George Q. Cannon published during that time, some nearly 200 different publications. So the first about half of the book is kind of a history and essay about what was going on and the conditions of the time and why this was so important. And then the second half gives bibliographic entries. If you're familiar with Flake and Draper's A Mormon Bibliography, kind of a similar idea. It gives a description of the book, tells about it, tells a little bit about its importance. There's full color photographs of some of these books and their covers and portions of them. And it's an absolutely beautiful book. It's Smythe Sewn, which, you know, doesn't happen quite as much anymore. It's a very, very nicely produced book, very similar to their book on the 1920 edition of the Book of Mormon that they did a couple of years ago. I'll be honest, it's a book for nerds. That was the very first thing I said in my review of it back for Christmas for the Association of Mormon Letters was, if you're a nerd, you got to get this book for Christmas. Very fun and kind of interesting book to have if you like geeky things and learning about history and kind of why some of these books and things came to be and the different versions of them that exist and things like that. A lot of fun there. Got one that's a little heavier, a little more serious, and this is called Mormon Settler Colonialism, Inventing the Lamanite by Elsie Boxer. Elsie Boxer is a Dakota Sioux and a couple other tribes she's associated with that I'll pronounce poorly, associate professor of history and Native studies at the University of South Dakota. And she wrote this book to discuss, I guess you might say, why Mormons have treated Native Americans the way they have. There's no history in this book. And okay, we're probably all familiar with the myth and the stories about, you know, Brigham Young saying it's better to feed the Indians, not to fight them, and how that's maybe not quite as accurate of what really happened. And unfortunately, there were some massacres as well as driving Natives out of the way to make room for Mormon settlers coming in. And she doesn't go in depth into those kind of experiences of exactly what happened and when and how many people died and that kind of a thing. But she covers different Mormon theology and teachings and how the Book of Mormon and other things within the church were used to justify the mistreatment of Native Americans, treating them as kind of second-class citizens, relegating them to the role of Lamanites and kind of what that means. She covers in four different chapters Mormon settler colonialism and the production of Lamanite discourse, what the Council of 50 had to play in this, the settler landscape, and then she kind of closes with talking about the Indian student placement program. Let me just give one quick little sample here of kind of some of the things she has to say. At one point she writes, Mormon settler colonialism, including Mormon settler fantasies, construct and institutionalize the Lamanite subject position. The Mormon settler fantasy provides a way to escape culpability for enacting violence against indigenous peoples as Mormon settlers have simultaneously experienced violence. And she just kind of helps rewrite the narrative and understanding of how, unfortunately, the church has treated indigenous people over the years and why, and kind of the doctrine and teachings behind that. One other one, again, this is one I haven't quite had the chance to go through too much yet, but make sure people are aware it's out there on a related subject. Max Perry Mueller released last year, Wakara's America, The Life and Legacy of a Native Founder of the American West. So I want to make people aware that that one came out. And then jumping up in time just a little bit, kind of touching again on the David O. McKay era. If there's anyone else that kind of really impacted the church during that time period that was outside of the realm of the general authorities, it was Ernest L. Wilkinson, the president of BYU, who was president of BYU almost the exact same length of time that David O. McKay was president of the church. And so they're very kind of intertwined. And Gary Bergera, and Signature Books produced this book, Educating Zion, The Diaries of BYU President Ernest L. Wilkinson, 1952 to 1971. And it really gives a fascinating behind-the-scenes look of not just the politics and things that were going on. And when I say politics, I'm talking about not like, you know, national politics, but the kind of goings-on behind the scenes at BYU, but in the church as well, and his interactions with general authorities and what was the growth that was going on in BYU and the church at the time and the various things that were happening. And he's got, I mean, he has all these fascinating connections with a number of general authorities and things that are going on, and the changes that were taking place with that were leading eventually to President Kimball's revelation on the priesthood and many other things. And so a lot of very interesting history there. One final similar book, more of a feminist side now, The Diaries of Carol Lynn Pearson, Mormon author, feminist and activist. There's actually going to be multiple volumes of this. This is volume one, which covers 1956 to 1990. Covers a lot of the same time period that's covered in her book, Goodbye, I Love You, and she writes about her husband coming out as gay and getting AIDS and passing away and a lot of other things that were going on during that time period. I'll give you just one fun little taste of some of the things she has to say here. This is an early entry from June 13th, 1961. She writes, I have been reading Brigham Young's discourses on the preexistence and plan of salvation. There is no peace within me. Why must my goal be ever to press onward to eternal increase? This strikes me as being told that I must stand in line for 24 hours a day in order to help pass beanbags down the row. I am repelled. It's kind of her, you know, if he went into his insights there on some of the teachings and things going on in the church. But if you like documentaries, if you like, you know, getting these different snippets of church history and stuff, a lot of good fun books this last year.
Great. Thank you. All right. Well, let's shift to literature, fiction, novels. We'll start with novels and short fiction collection and then go on to poetry and memoirs. So let me tell you about some what I think are the most significant novels of the year that I'm aware of so far, at least. One is John Bunyan's The Dead Fathers. John Bunyan's one of our great novelist, short fiction authors. And since his retirement from BYU, he's a professor at BYU, he's really, we got limited, I mean, with his teaching responsibilities, we got a limited number of novels that he wrote while he was there. But since his retirement, he's really blossomed and been able to publish almost every year a novel that are all very remarkable. And this newest one, Dead Fathers, is about an old cantankerous man who's living in poverty, a derelict trailer. He's a disaffected Latter-day Saint, philosophical, but feels like he has little to live for, separated from his family. And then his dead fathers start to appear. Literally, every night his ancestors materialize around his table and play poker with him and dispense advice. And it starts with his actual grandfather's father, but then mother's aunts, and tons of characters start appearing. And their motives are elusive. What exactly do they want him to do? They want him to do something, but what is it? It can be very cryptic, but it builds up. He has this great, it starts a little slow perhaps, but it builds up into this wonderful symphony of characters and experiences, and has just a beautiful, transcendent ending to this novel. So I very highly recommend John Bunyan's The Fathers. Another one is Karen Anderson's Things I Didn't Do. This is a parallel novel to her 2023 novel called What Falls Away, which won the Association for Mormon Letters Award that year. The first novel is about a woman who, from Utah, who became estranged from her family and left. She gave up a son. She had a son born out of wedlock, and she gave it up for adoption and then left Utah. And then she's coming back years later and reconnecting with the roots and finding her son that she'd placed. And that was an amazing novel. And then this is a parallel novel which follows the son. You know, what happened to him growing up, finding out that he was adopted at some point, trying to connect with this culture of his rural community. It's set in the Utah's Book Cliffs region in Carbon County. And she's not only wonderful at showing family relations, but also the landscape, really great depictions of the Utah landscape, the splendor of these mountains and mesas and canyons. There's a real thrilling Western adventure in there, but framed by this heartfelt family drama. Another one is, and this is actually, I'll turn it over to Andrew, Stephen LeSueur's Every Man a Prophet. Andrew, you want to tell us about that one?
Yes. If you're going to press me, I would say this is probably actually my favorite book that I read last year, a very good book by Stephen C. LeSueur, who's probably more well known as being a historian, one of his most famous books being The 1838 War in Missouri. And interestingly enough, about a year and a half ago, out of the blue, I get an email from him. We'd never met. They get an email. He's like, "Hey, Andrew, I kind of heard about you. Can you help me get in touch with Coford Books? I'd like to publish this novel I've written." And so I was able to kind of set him up there, and they were able to get me an early copy. And this is a very interesting book. Every Man a Prophet is set in Norway in the late 1960s. And it's the story of two missionaries and their mission president. And everybody in this book is kind of lost, and they're on a journey to kind of discover who they are and what's going on. The mission president, President Torsen, is a very charismatic man. The members of the church there speak of him as being the prophet of Norway, and he's very popular there. Unfortunately, not so popular at church headquarters. You see him as maybe being a little too charismatic and not always maybe staying in line like he needs to be. It's also about two of his missionaries who have disappeared. They've kind of taken off to go do some proselyting without saying they were going. One of them is kind of a musical genius, a very dedicated Latter-day Saint. Seems to be about the hardest working missionary out there. And his secret is that he is homosexual, and he feels that if he works hard enough as a missionary, he will overcome this and not be gay anymore. And he's on a journey of discovery to kind of find out who he really is. And he gets outed at BYU, and there's a lot of problems going on. And then he has a companion who's kind of in the shadow of his father, who's something of a famous teacher in the church. And he's trying to figure out, again, where he fits in and everything that's going on. And they kind of disappear to the backwoods of Norway to do some teaching. And so the church goes into a panic, and their families go into a panic, and the mission president's out searching for them. And all these men find out a lot more about who they really are and where their journeys need to go next. And it really touched my life. This, if you can talk about a book or a novel, maybe having the ability to change your life or to impact your kind of real world experience, this is one I think that can do that. I really absolutely loved this book. Very, very, very good. I highly recommend it.
We have a review of it coming out by Roger Terry. And both Roger and Stephen served missions in Europe in the late 60s, early 70s. And so, you know, they know this period, they know this area well. And he talked about, in the review, he talks about this, a leitmotif that appears in this book is this tension between bureaucratic authority of the church and then this yearning for charismatic experience that we get, you know, from the scriptures.
Yeah.
And whether it's the two missionaries who have very different ways of seeking a relationship from God, or the mission president who's very open about his own spiritual manifestations, or this Elder Tanner's father who publishes these pamphlets that upset a bureaucratic apostle, the seeking of revelation that can run afoul of the church bureaucracy, this tension is that we have here in the church, which is very, you know, Max Weber talks about the bureaucratic taming of charisma, right? And so I think it's a fascinating idea, and the reviewer spoke very highly of it, so I'm excited to read this as well. Andrew, you had a couple other things you wanted to
I want to touch on really quickly. So this one actually is a little bit older, but I just barely found out about it. It's from 2023. It's called World Running Down, and the author is Al Hess. Let me just read the back of the, and if you like kind of alternative histories, things kind of set in a similar but slightly different, you know, history than actually took place, the description says, Valentine West is a salvager in the future wastelands of Utah. Wrestling with body dysphoria, he dreams of earning enough money to afford citizenship in Salt Lake City, a utopia where the testosterone and surgery he needs to transition is free, the food is plentiful, and folk are much less likely to be shot full of arrows by salt pirates. Earning that kind of money is a pipe dream until he meets the exceptionally handsome Osric. Osric, a once powerful AI in Salt Lake City, has been forced into an android body against his will and sent to offer Valentine a job as an escort service seeking to retrieve stolen androids. And so this kind of sci-fi fantasy version of Utah and a bit of a distant, you know, dystopian future. So if you're into that kind of a thing, that might be kind of a fun one to check out. Another one, this one did come out last year. This is a two-part set so far. The author is Ryan Macbeth. They're called the Deseret series, and there's two books in this series so far, The Last Republic and Lies to Rule Men. This is an alternative history where the USA never finished its manifest destiny. It only made it about to the Mississippi River or somewhere, Colorado, and the state of Deseret survived. And so the Mormons have their own country in the state of Deseret, and they're an independent country. And the United States is a separate country. And it's set about in the time we're living now, and these two are kind of coming to head, and there's a war going on and other stuff. So again, if you're into kind of this alternative history and what maybe could have been type thing, those are some that you might be interested in checking out. Some kind of fun different takes on reality and things there. So
no, good. Yeah, and that fits it very well with my next one as well. But actually, before I do that, let me just mention Stephen Lesueur, the author of Every Man a Prophet, unfortunately passed away in July 2025. So we only got the one novel, but it looks like it's a great novel. Okay, but this connection with the alternative histories and kind of speculative fiction that way, DJ Butler, Dave Butler, and his co-author Aaron Michael Ritchie put out the third novel in their The Cunning Man series, and this third novel is called The Familiar Spirit. Now, I've raved about these novels, the Cunning Man series novels, several times in the past. These are fantasies that set in an alternative Depression era Utah in which magic works. And the main character, Hiram, and his adopted son, Michael, are Mormons. Michael is actually a Navajo. Hiram's a European Mormon, who embark on these paranormal investigations, rife with spiritual and physical danger, hedge magic, stubborn spirits, and haunting. And as a cunning man, Hiram practices folkloric magic in conjunction with his priesthood power. And, includes gifts of the spirit mentioned in the scriptures, such as discernment, healing, tongues, protections. But other practices that are more outside the mainstream tradition, like speaking with spirits and placing summoning in certain circles. He sees himself as a true blue church-going Mormon practicing the true religion, and he's sent on these missions by a presiding bishopric member who sees him as an important person in the work, although there's other leaders in the church who are not so happy about still the folk magic still being used. And this novel, the third one, they move from rural Utah, where the first two novels were set, into the Mormon colonies of Chihuahua, Mexico. And, you know, where at this point, there's still a lot of polygamous people and they're very scarred from revolutions and persecutions. There's blight and famine and racial tensions in the air, and Mormon and Catholic lore mixing with Santa Muerte and folk Mexican magic and demonic forces. And so it makes for a great mix. So I love these novels, so I highly recommend them. Also in the speculative world, Henrik Sorensen's Corsair. Henrik Sorensen is, people might know him from his very active Twitter content personality, Noam Chomsky, or at Nihilist for Jesus, who's a very fun, interesting, unique voice on Twitter. But he's come out with the novel and also a short fiction collection. The novel Corsair is a space opera, and it revolves around these questions of agency. Who's capable of acquiring it and exercising it? Looking at AI and robots, and so it's not, Mormons don't appear in this, but it's in the tradition of Card and Sorensen, Mormon themes are very thick on the ground in this, and it makes agency rather than say love or faith or other things the litmus test of what humanity is, and is this principle that must be upheld, defended, and promoted for all others. He also came out with a short fiction collection, A Thin Black Veil, which is a collection of Gothic stories drawn from Mormon cultural, historical, and cosmological landscape. People have liked that as well. So Henrik Sorensen is the author of those two. All right, let's move to poetry. And Andrew, I'm going to kind of switch the order on this a little bit. I'll tell you what.
If we're jumping around a bit, can I throw one in real quick?
Sure.
One other book, if I can, Andrew, in the kind of speculative fiction category, if I may. Many of you probably have been following Mehdi Harrison's Vampires in the Temple series of books. BCC Press has been releasing one of these every year, right around Halloween, of course, for about 5 years now, set in an alternative world where when the church arrived in Utah, they found vampires. And there's also werewolves and other, such creatures and things. And it's followed a hero, Jack Hardy, who's a werewolf, and his involvement with the church and these creatures and everything. And the most recent one that came out this year was called The Ancient One. And a quick description states that Jack Hardy is once again called to deal with bodies of humans on Vampire Island, and thus begins an investigation that shows Jack new powers of a group of immortals and the human lives and the power of the ancient and powerful figures on the island that might possibly stand against them, and to find out if humans can work with vampires, half vampires, and even werewolves like Jack. So kind of a fun fantasy take on Utah and the church and history and everything else. And I've really enjoyed this series. I've gotten every one as they've come out and I've quite enjoyed them. If you like that kind of fantasy feel, maybe think kind of Harry Potter's type stuff for Mormons, maybe. But a lot of fun stuff in there, vampires, werewolves, dark powers and such things. If you've enjoyed that series, definitely make sure to check that one out as well.
Okay, thank you. All right, so now we're going to look at poetry. And the theme for this year, I would say, is epic poetry. Epic poetry, these long book length poems in the tradition of Milton's Paradise Lost and Dante's Divine Comedy. And there's three books that came out in this form this year. The first one is a critical edition of Orson F. Whitney's Elias, An Epic of Ages, a critical edition made by Reed L. Nielsen, one of our great historians. And he is taking this kind of key literary, as far as the creation of Mormon literature, Orson F. Whitney's Elias was first published in 1904 and then refined in a 1914 edition, a 10-canto epic, which, like Milton, is looking at this kind of big, scope of the pre-mortal existence and creation, using the Latter-day Saint scripture and tradition to look at the mission of Jesus Christ at the center of a cosmic narrative that spans premortality, the Savior's mortal ministry, the apostasy, the dispensation of the fullness of times. And so Nielsen in this critical edition, is looking at, he's comparing the two versions. He's bringing lots of literary analysis and, contemporary responses to,
you know, what was going on with the time when Whitney's writing this and what, you know, what's coming into this. And so we've got a reviewer out looking at this right now. So I haven't read it yet, but this is a key work, and Nielsen is a great historian. So I'm sure this is an important work. But then, so then there's two new epic poems, books of epic poetry that came out this year as well. The first one is Zachary Hutchings' Joseph and Epic, published by the University of Illinois Press. So, you know, University of Illinois Press does not usually publish literature. They usually publish histories and social, and, you know, they have this, you know, big Mormon studies series, but they have never done literature up to now. But apparently they were impressed by this book enough to publish it. And it's an iambic pentameter ode to Joseph Smith from his birth through his days at Kirtland. And there's six books it's divided into six volumes within the one book. And each volume is, well, okay. There's kind of the general history that you'd expect, the story of Joseph Smith maybe, but also it's got some dazzling speculation. The second book is a council of devils plotting to thwart Joseph's destiny. And then the fifth book is a imagining of what is in the 116 pages that Martin Harris lost, the Book of Lehi, right? So it's also just great poetry. And besides the poetry, there's these illustrations drawn by an artist who calls himself Goodwin that are really just amazing stuff. They're right up there with the poetry for the worth of this book. Some of them playfully illustrate scenes such as Joseph courting Emma, while others go deeper, like Satan's Congress in the Grove, which has this edgy echo of Da Vinci's Last Supper, and the opening of Joseph's vision, which kind of torques the vision with a cross between William Blake and Buddhist temple art. So the art's a great part of this. And, you know, he has all these different voices. I mean, of course, there's Joseph Smith, but then there's a hyper-literate Emma Smith who gives some great orations to Joseph. And there's Mary Whitmer, who talks about her encounter with Moroni, and just a fascinating book. So I really highly recommend this. And then also another book of epic poetry is Charlie Mullins Glenn's Brighter and Brighter Until the Perfect Day. And this is also a kind of in the tradition of Orson F. Whitney, a Miltonian type story of the plan of salvation. It's epic poetry written in blank verse in this case. And the reviewer said she uses fierce imagination, thoughtful language, and meticulous craft. It focuses more on the role of women that they played in the plan of salvation. And she has this theological speculation envisioning the Holy Ghost as Heavenly Mother, or Heavenly Mother as the Holy Ghost. An idea that, you know, we've been heard circulating in LDS feminist circles for several years now. But so Heavenly Mother is a key character in this book. It's not that long of a poem. It's only about, the book's about 60 pages long with some illustrations. So there's our epic poetry. A couple more books of poetry, and then I'll throw over to hear what Andrew has. One is Marilyn Bushman Carleton's We Wore Dresses. This is a collection that focuses on women's choices in an explicitly eternal context, cataloging women's life on earth, you know, a section on childhood. She kind of goes, you know, the poems go in order of life. The ones about childhood, kind of focusing on the constrictions that females faced in Mormon Utah in the 20th century, leading to marriage, pregnancy, aging bodies, the passage of time, and a very tactile, mortal, you know, what it's like to be in a female mortal body in these poems. And the reviewer really liked that as well. And then one more, Stephen L. Peck's Experiments in the Fading Light. Stephen L. Peck, our great scientist and novelist, is also a poet. And it's a grab bag of lots of different themes. Also, you know, things about aging, immortal bodies, struggling with age. Yeah, as you would expect with Stephen, quite several about changing climate and its effects on Earth, including forest fires. He uses all different kinds of poetic forms in the collection. And he's just, you know, a great literary voice that we have. So, Andrew, you had a couple other poetry books you want to mention?
Yes. Before I do, let me also give a quick plug for the critical edition of Elias, an epic for the ages. I'm an Orson Whitney fan. Over the years, I've tracked down some first edition copies of his various books, including, I've got right here, a 1904 edition of Elias, an epic for the ages. And it's an absolutely beautiful book, one of my favorites in my collection. So I was really happy to see this book come out. Reed Nielsen's a great author, and he's done an excellent job of, you know, contextualizing the poem, providing some, you know, appendices and introductory essays, footnotes to explain everything that's kind of going on, and give a good in-depth feel for it. So highly recommend that book as well. I'm going to be honest, I've gained an appreciation for poetry in recent years, and maybe this will help to contextualize how much I've enjoyed these two books. When I was in high school, every year as a part of our English class, we had to do a poetry unit. We had to read poems and collect poems and write some poetry and put them in a little portfolio. In my freshman year in high school, I named my portfolio Poems Suck. In my sophomore year in high school, I named it Poems Suck Part 2. And I was not a fan of poetry. It was one of those things I was kind of forced to do. But I really come to love and appreciate poetry in recent years. And two of the books I've enjoyed the most this year are by Jim Richards, Song for My Left Ear, Song for My Right Ear. Richards is a professor at Brigham Young University, Idaho. And he wrote this very brief book that, if I had to give a word to describe it, it would probably be memory. Memory is a big theme in a lot of these poems. And just some really fun things in here. I do a lot of camping with my son. We'd like to do a lot of things together. And this gave me a great feel for, you know, recalling some of these memories and times together. Let me just give a couple of brief snippets here. In a poem called Road Trip, he writes, "Do you remember as a child coming home from a long road trip, half asleep, but sensing the highway exit, the stoplights, the smell of the car, the turns telling you where you are without looking out the window? The feeling when you know you've pulled into the driveway, the door opens, letting in summer air, so familiar. All memory rushes back. You are home and in the arms of someone strong enough to carry you, have lifted you, and you can walk, but you pretend to be asleep because your head is on the shoulder of one who cares enough to take you away for a while and bring you back to a place you didn't know you loved." And then one other quick little snippet here. This is one of my favorite little bits. He writes, "You cannot prepare for warm days. You can only let them hold you when they arrive and try to recall them when they're gone." A lot of good, fun, beautiful little poems in there. And then this other one is called Making a Kingdom of It by Lance Larson, who has been a poet laureate of Utah. And he's got a lot of excellent, beautiful poems in here. I really quite enjoyed this book. I want to give you also one little feel for this. There's a poem in here called Blessing the Sacrament in My In-Law's Garage. And this is reflecting on an experience he had during COVID and going into the garage of his in-laws to bless the sacrament for them because they were aged and everything. And, you know, we talk a lot about the church, you know, this idea of, you know, when we, if you do it unto the least of these, you do it unto me. And this idea that when we are serving others, we are truly kind of serving Christ. And he writes of being in this garage and states, "Jesus, though, is still here, not homemade or wonder, but torn English muffin. And soon he'll be trickles of water in a Dixie cup. He's summer solstice, our longest day and shortest night. He's robin and finch, and sometimes an elegant Steller's jay ricocheting tree to tree. He's the hoe that can chop weeds till the sunset, and the broom that sweeps away the mouse droppings and crumbs, and he's the sweet tangle of silver-white lights will drape over the flocked tree come Christmas." And just to get a very personal feel, a lot of great poems in here about family and life and the various things that tend to touch us. And I would highly recommend both of those, or short collections of poetry. Very beautiful, good little collections there.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, Lance Larson is one of our great poets, and this is a collection. It's mostly free verse, right?
Yes, correct.
And we have a review coming up soon that talks about how he finds divinity in the mundane moments of life, and that he's really good at this kind of tactile details, explaining this kind of for these kind of simple things. Okay, thank you. All right, let's go to creative nonfiction. So this includes personal essay collections and memoirs. First one I want to mention is Ryan W. Davis, his Dispatches from Mormon Zion, a collection of 10 essays. This is published by Erdemass, a major publisher of religious book issues on religious books from the wider Christian world. So a very respected publisher. And this is a collection of personal essays, or essays, I guess, on these tenets that, on the question of Zion, on how to build Zion. And his kind of central tenet is that Mormonism is magnified and made richer by considering it outside of the narrow confines of strict rules, and essentially that Mormon people grow closer to a Zion-like life when love, not these strictures, is primary. But then, he takes these ideas and looks at lots of different kind of cultural experiences, his own personal life experiences, philosophical explorations, looking at the works of Taylor Swift and using those as examples of Zion communities. All this kind of building up this theme of when we rise above self-interest and instead focus on kindness and love for each other, especially for those we don't have any responsibility over or even actively dislike, then moving towards building a Zion community. So we have a very good review of that coming out soon. Another one is, this is actually not a memoir, so maybe shouldn't go here, but James Goldberg and his wife, Nicole White Wilkes Goldberg, the couple, great literary couple, has a book called Latter-day Sick about James's grandfather, a person who came from India, who is from the Sikh religion, and coming to Utah, and his experiences and about the kind of religious practices of the Sikh community and how that compares with Mormonism. And then, of course, his family joining Mormonism and the blending of those two cultures. So I have not read that, but I fully expect this is probably an important work. Andrew, you had a couple you wanted to mention, a couple of memoirs.
Yes, thank you. Let me second James Goldberg really quick. I think I've got every book he's ever written, and they're always very good. I also haven't had the chance to get into this one yet, but I've enjoyed everything he's written, and this one, I'm sure, will be another very good book by him. I have a couple, three memoirs I want to touch on here. The first one is another one of my favorites from this last year. It's called Believing in Indians, A Mixed Blood Odyssey by Tony Evans. Who is an enrolled member of the Mohawks of Quebec. He is a religion and anthropology reporter up here in this part of Idaho, author of several histories. And he uses that reference to Homer very deliberately in his title. This is kind of his life journey to figure out just what does it mean to be Indian, to be Native American. And he travels kind of all over the United States and all over the world. He actually tells in one chapter the story of being in Italy and running into a member of the church who was a fairly recent convert from São Paulo, Brazil, who had gone to Italy to research his family history. But he frames this with two interesting stories. He talks about in the beginning how he had turned in all the official paperwork to be recognized as a member of the tribe. And he talks about getting this package in the mail from a Monsieur Cloutier, Director of Aboriginal Affairs of Quebec, saying, Mr. Evans, you're officially now a member of the tribe. And then he also talks about how when he was in third grade, he's about the same age I am, so this would have been in about the mid-70s, he was sitting in his class and it was Thanksgiving time and they were talking about the pilgrims and the Native Americans and the first Thanksgiving, and he raises his hand and he says, well, I'm an Indian. And his teacher said to him, now Tony, we all know there aren't any Indians anymore, they all assimilated into the country. And he's like, well, wait a minute. And so he goes home to his mom. He's like, Mom, aren't we Indians? My teacher said there aren't any more Indians, which led to his mom having a fairly serious talk with the teacher, but and then he kind of builds upon those and very interesting journeys. He kind of goes through his life and tries to discover what does it mean to be a Native American and an Indian and this kind of a thing. And not a lot of direct per se Mormon content, but I think this is one because it ties in a lot with Utah and Idaho. And of course, as members of the church, we have this big belief in, you know, Native Americans and Lamanites and these kinds of things. So that might be a very interesting book for people who would listen to Dialogue or read Dialogue and Association for Mormon Letters to check out. Another book that I really loved from this year is called Wolf Act, a memoir by A.J. Romero. He grew up in Sandy, Utah, and is a writer, photographer, educator, currently teaching in Columbus, Ohio. Also happens to be homosexual and really struggled with his identity in the church and what that meant to be gay and to be a Mormon and how he kind of struggled there. And let me just read one little passage that maybe some people who have been queer members of the church or maybe who have struggled with their membership and other challenges could relate to. He talks about trying to overcome these feelings, and he writes, "Each Sunday at sacrament with family, I would ingest bread and water as symbols of Christ's body and blood. These things he sacrificed for my sins. Tears would line my eyes, my tiny empty cup clattering on the metal tray. I tried to imagine how with every sin, Christ had to suffer a little more in the Garden of Gethsemane. I pressed the idea into my mind like a nail. If I could make myself heard enough, maybe I'd finally stop sinning. Maybe I could be pure again." And I think anyone who has struggled with those, you know, feelings and that identity, or maybe struggled with, you know, their identity in the church at all, would be able to relate really well with this book and AJ's journey as he tries to figure out just who he is and as he writes this memoir. Another very good one, Deseret Birthright, a Midwife's Memoir by Lori Rankle, published by the University of Utah Press. She has been a midwife in Southern Utah for a number of years, and she writes of her experiences and tells of, you know, being a member of the church and her experiences in that, as well as her experience as a midwife, and tells a lot of interesting stories and experiences that she has had. I like one passage in particular where she talks about her father coming home from work after he's had an accident. And she mentions here, I'll just read a little short part of this really quick. "My father came home from the auto body shop one day with a gash in his upper thigh. As he unwrapped the masking tape from a bleeding wound, he told me, just a child of 8 or 9, that his garments had saved him from cutting his leg off with a saw." And she kind of relates this story of her father talking about how he nearly cut his leg off with a saw, and kind of related this idea that, you know, some of us who are maybe a little older, and our parents would certainly remember when we used to kind of have this idea that the garments might somehow physically protect you, and how he and she had been taught that. But she writes some very fascinating stories about her experience as a midwife, and very fun one to check out. There, Women of Feminist Women's History there for Utah.
Okay, thank you. All right, how about let's touch on graphic novels for a second. And we had one that I've been excited for quite a while. I've seen she's been giving out little hints of it, and now we finally get it. Camilla Stark's The Desert Prophet. Andrew, what can you tell us about that?
I'll be honest, I came into this a little late. I found out about The Desert Prophet when Connor Hilton sent me a review of it, and I was fascinated enough by his review that I first went to Amazon and was about to buy a paperback copy when I found out that the author still had leftover copies of the hardback from her Kickstarter that she'd done, and I invested in the hardback. And I absolutely love this graphic novel. It is a very fun and interesting take. It's about this character who is the desert prophet. He's this kind of skeletal figure, and he journeys through this kind of wasteland. It kind of had feels of my brain is freezing on me for a minute here.
Mad Max.
Thank you, Andrew. Yeah, so for me, the Desert Prophet gave me two feels. One was Mad Max, as you just mentioned, and the other is something kind of along the lines of The Lorax by Dr. Seuss. But this character of the Desert Prophet is kind of wandering through this kind of post-apocalyptic world. He mentions early on the pollution has turned the moon to blood and stars are falling from the sky, and it shows us crashing satellite and homes flooded out and the earth is shaking. And he takes this journey through the desert and he meets these other fascinating characters, an accountant and another prophet. And he finally meets this desert god. And as he does and begins to kind of reconcile with him, he learns a lot about kind of what it truly means to be who he is and what it truly means to serve and to be kind of a child of God. And a very unique and interesting book. The hardback is absolutely beautiful. If you can get a copy, it's got this like kind of soft felt cover with gold inlay on it and these beautiful end papers. And it has at the back all sorts of extra artwork and descriptions and sketches and other things. And this is, I hope Camille Lestart does more, because this is a beautiful and a very well-written graphic novel. I highly, highly recommend picking up a copy of The Desert Prophet.
Okay, thank you. And you also wanted to mention some things about Matt Page, one of our favorite illustrators out there.
Oh, yes. I'm a huge Matt Page fan. You might be able to see back up here. I've got my Brigham Young Climbing the Salt Lake Temple framed on my wall that Matt did a few years ago. He's had kind of a prolific year, a bunch of short things. I just want to touch on a few of these. Had a collection of his artwork over several years that he's compiled into a little zine called A Thick Gray Voice. No writing in this. There's various artwork that he has done. Kind of a fun little book there. If you're familiar with his Future Day Saints series, he's done three graphic novels on what the church might be like in the year 2999. And this is actually not another graphic novel, but he's conceptualized what if they made a video game in the year 2999. And this is the instruction manual for the video game, Future Day Saints, the Battle for New Zion video game instruction manual, and kind of some fun there. And if you bought the special edition, it even comes with a little 5.5-inch floppy disk that he's kind of personalized and had some fun with there. You mentioned Stephen L. Peck a little earlier in the poetry section. They did a book together called Eulogy for Grandma's Little Alien. And Stephen Peck wrote the story of this kind of bizarre-looking little alien, kind of a garden gnome type thing. And this is kind of from the perspective of one of Grandma's descendants talking about Grandma's little alien. And it's a fun and beautiful little story, and Matt provides the artwork to go along with that. And another fun one there. For those of us who are old enough to remember, maybe either seen while it was alive or after it was stuffed, we've got Shasta, the story of Utah's famous liger. Back in 1948, the Hogle Zoo had a baby liger. Father was a lion, mom was a tiger, and it lived in the Hogle Zoo for about 25 years. And then after it passed away, it was stuffed. And they even had one of those little machines you can put a quarter in, you get a little wax version of the liger. I remember getting a wax version of the liger when I was a kid back in the 70s. And it's just kind of a fun little story about the liger. And then one other from Matt. When Steamboat Willie entered the public domain a couple of years ago, Matt started a series of short comics called Yesterday's Tomorrow. And Steamboat Willie is enlisted by these time operatives from the future to try and kind of save history from an evil time-traveling version of Hitler. And this is the second volume in the series, and the various adventures that Steamboat Willie and these other time travelers are having trying to stop a time-traveling baby and tween Hitler from taking over the world. Matt, if you've read Matt Page, you know he's got this very unique kind of way of doing things, different kind of sense of humor and different way, you know, just very fun kind of strange fantasy type approach and a lot of fun there. If you're a fan of Matt Page or you want something a little different, check those out. A lot of fun there.
Great. Thank you. All right. Any other books we want to bring up? Thank you, Andrew. I think you had a couple more.
Yeah, I'll throw in a few more here really quick that came out this year. If you've been following Dan McClellan at all, he used to work for Church Translation Department in the LDS Church, started doing a podcast a few years ago on TikTok and in other places called Data Over Dogma, where he talks about kind of what the Bible really has to say. Ended up making that kind of his full-time job and became very popular online. And he had a book come out this last year called The Bible Says So, that compiles 19 different chapters and some of the most popular topics from his podcast. How did we get the Bible? The Bible says God lies. The Bible says slavery is wrong. You know, what the Bible has to say on homosexuality and other things, and kind of goes into those things he tends to cover with the benefit of footnotes and other things you can't always get in a podcast. And so that's one worth checking out there if you've enjoyed Dan McClellan, especially maybe going into the Old Testament for the study for Sunday school this year in the LDS Church. That would be one to maybe grab on to get a little more biblical insight. Another one worth checking out, Tending the Sacred, How Indigenous Wisdom Will Save the World by Darren Perry. Darren Perry is the former chair of the Northwest Band of Shoshones, wrote the first book on the Bear River Massacre by a Native perspective. And this kind of follow-up book from BCC Press gives his kind of wisdom and approach, Native Americans' understanding on the importance of the environment and protecting our environment and why we need to be a little better, caretakers of, the earth and the wind and the sky and the waters, how we can learn from Native American approaches on healing and health and other things like that. And I'm a big fan of and a friend of Darren Perry, and it's an excellent little book. Highly recommend that one. In connection kind of with that, again, not a lot of direct LDS content, but more Utah content. A couple of books from the University of Utah Press, An Exaltation of Parks, John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s Crusade to a Save America's Wonderlands, by Stephen Kemp from the University of Utah Press, covers some of the early history of national parks, a number of which were in Utah. And then another on the same subject, Southwestern National Monuments, Frank Pinkley and the Rise of the National Park System, which covers a lot of the Southern Utah national parks and kind of their place and role. And then one other, At Last She Said It, Honest Conversations About Faith, Church, and Everything in Between by Susan Hinckley and Cynthia Winwards from Signature Books. It covers a lot of women's and feminist perspective on various matters in relation to the church and ways to help women who have maybe struggled with things like obedience, blessings, fear, faith, repentance, the patriarchy, and other things. It contains like essays and dialogue by and between these two women and others, and some good insights and perspectives in there.
All right. Well, that's a lot. It's a lot of great books that I think I'm looking forward to. I'm going to carve out time. There's several of these books now I have on my list that I'm going to attack here in the next couple of months. And it's just a fun group. Thank you very much. So thank you, Nicholas. And thank you, Andrew. This show is produced by Daniel Foster Smith, who also provides music, and our content manager is Emily Jensen. To hear more, go to dialoguejournal.com.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.